and welcome to Canqueer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith.
I'm Sebastian.
And Sebastian, you're a little under the weather today.
I am in good spirits, but not in good health.
Sadly, those good spirits do not currently include gin, whiskey, or vodka, but maybe later.
Well, I mean,
maybe
after I recover a bit.
My mum was talking about in the UK, they're introducing extra hours or extra days vacation for people who go on smoke breaks.
Okay.
And this does relate to what we're talking about. So
there are people who don't go on smoke breaks?
Yeah, sorry, that's okay. The one, yeah. And they were looking at something like 4 or 5 days extra vacation day.
For non-smokers?
For non-smokers, yeah.
Oh, wow.
And they were like, wow, that's so many. And we did the math, and it was like, well, let's say, you know, you're there for like maybe an hour or two, let's say even 2 hours. You go, get your coat on, go outside, have a smoke break, come back.
Right.
That's like maybe 10, 15 minutes over an 8-hour shift. That's like...
And you probably do that
like
twice.
An hour.
Yeah. Yeah.
Half hour to an hour over, you know, 50 work weeks, so many days. You're looking at something like 15 to 17 days worth of time spent popping out for a smoke break.
Yeah.
So the 3 or 4 for non-smokers is really... like pittance on that time being lost.
But you don't have to go into work on those days.
That's true.
It's like you're spending more time on a smoke break than you are on your non-smoker holidays, but you're doing those in 15-minute increments while at work.
This is true. So yeah. The incentive here is clearly...
to chew Nicorette.
Yeah,
yeah.
And not smoke. Yeah. I think it's a cool idea. And the reason why I remembered it was because my mum was saying that often in Wales, you know, I was there recently, that everybody would go down the pub for a pint at lunch.
Right.
And then come back and carry on working. Now, one time I did that and it was like a Friday afternoon and I was like, I didn't bring lunch. I'll get like a curry or something from the pub across the road,
right.
Deacon Brodie's. And I had a pint to go with it because, you know, you're in a pub. And I swear to whoever's listening that I just about fell asleep whilst I was still at the pub. So
I see.
I don't know. How do people do lunchtime drinking?
I don't even know. My brother occasionally gets taken out to meetings when he's at work. And he's learned the hard way to never, ever, ever have whiskey with lunch. Because the afternoon is just no good.
You just have to write it all off.
They've had to send him home.
Yeah.
He's an apartment head, so I mean...
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That's not good. I know that once for a Christmas...
It's considered part of doing business, though. If your clients get you so drunk you have to go home, they're just like, well, don't do it more than once a month. It's really weird.
Well, let us know what you think. Do you think that non-smokers should get extra vacation days? And do you drink and lunch? Obviously, no driving, but do you drink and lunch? Let us know.
I think the answer with the smoking thing is yes, obviously, but how many days is fair? That's
yes,
the tricky one.
That is a tricky one. I would love to get more days because I don't smoke. I mean, nobody
Canada
in my office
smokes.
Canada
has the fewest bank holidays in the world and the fewest stat day off days for work as well.
Well, they're introducing a new one.
A new
Saturday holiday, yeah.
Okay.
They haven't figured out which date, but it's going to be one around, I think it's around raising awareness and education, the residential schools.
Okay.
So that'll be coming soon. I think it's next year.
People have been pushing for a Louis Riel Day for decades now, and that, I think, is overdue. Louis Riel being... well, actually, you could either do Louis Riel or Thayendaega. Those are two major historical figures in the history of Canada who were Indigenous, who fought for Indigenous rights. Thayendaega had a little bit more success. He was known as Joseph Brant, went over to George III, basically said, hello, could you not? And he said, oh, I suppose so. And it went really well. And then he died and got replaced by his crazy son, who was like, no, we're going to go back to what we were doing.
This is the really abridged version.
Very abridged version. But yeah, no, apparently George III really liked Thayendaega. And it was his son who was like, no.
It was actually one of the recommendations from the reconciliation that happened. So it's one of the governments actually picking up on, and it looks like it's set to come in. I can't remember the exact details on it, but that's exciting. So working lunch.
I think the third Friday of every July should be, it's too dang hot day.
It's too dang hot. You know, you say that, but a lot of people, there's been articles in The Economist and New York Times, Washington Post, everyone's talking about, are summer holidays too long? Now, apparently students have their memory of anything learned over the summer holidays. And what they found was that some schools now in September, now that they're starting up again, have had to cancel school days because it's too dang hot.
Okay.
It's like the summer equivalent of a snow day where there's just not enough AC in the building and they can't offer like a healthy environment.
Well, I know in Japan, they do, it's a little bit lumpy. The original idea was 3 months on, 1 month off for middle school and high school. Now, the way it actually works out, it's like the semester's like 4 months on, half a month off, three, and then 1.5, or something like that. It's really inconsistent. But the general idea is it's supposed to be 3 on, 1 off, because then, I mean, you're around more, you spend less time away forgetting everything. And that 1 month off, you're not actually necessarily off because, you know, the school clubs may still be running, it may be cram time for the upcoming exam, something like that. Like that, the schools are still open, there's just not classes.
That was actually part of the critique, is that by having all of these students off over the summer, you know, people in wealthy families are able to put their kids through summer camps, are able to put them through ballet lessons or Latin or, you know, sports camps and other thingy camps. And they reckon that summer holidays are partly to blame for the wealth knowledge gap. So the fact that, you know, wealthy kids seem to be doing so much better over time in school. And they partly attribute that to the continued learning in the
partly
summer.
Partly is definitely fair, because something like that is a hugely complicated issue and you can't really boil it down to one thing. But this is, I would believe that this is a major contributor to that for sure.
Well, as we've not yet even discussed a single LGBT topic, I'm going to jump right into the first one, which is not Canadian.
Ooh.
Now, I was away in Wales, my home country, for a couple of weeks for a funeral. My grandmother passed away recently. And whilst I was there, I was shook. I was shook, I tell you.
By an earthquake?
No.
By a landslide?
No.
By a lorry that drove by too fast?
Yes, but not on that's not what I'm referring to. What really shook me was that my town of Kaneki, which I dare people to try and say, LLANELLI, is had a pride parade.
Okay.
Now, this is the type of place where at the Santa parade, someone got stabbed. So it's a bit rough, this town.
Also, the only Gay in the Village skit was kind of based on the kind of...
Well, the only Gay in the Village was based in Chandui Brevi. And there is a Chandui Brevi just outside of Carmarthen, which is sort of nearish to Kaneki. They're about the same size towns. Kaneki is more rough than...
More rough.
Absolutely. It's not a nice
more
place
hills.
To live. Less hills. It's on the coast.
Fewer hills.
But it's...
I thought there was a general rule of thumb. It's weird, but it's generally true that the hillier a city is in Wales, the more likely it is to be rough. And the more flat it is, the more likely it is to be prosperous.
Well, I mean, all of Wales is on the damn hill, so it's like there's no real conclusion there. But no, what was interesting was... This is a community where it is not safe to walk down the street.
Right.
If you look obviously gay.
Right.
Like, gay bashing is a thing that happens in Kaneki. You know, I mentioned somebody got stabbed at a Santa parade. That's not a joke. Someone did get stabbed at a Santa parade. So I was talking to my friends who had organized this Pride parade, and they didn't have it going through the town center.
Okay.
They had it along... the waterfront on the waterfront park. And a part of me is a bit torn about this. And I think now that Canada has 110 pride parades and they're sort of blooming and popping up everywhere, what I want to talk to you about is, should pride parades be just a place to build community? That's sort of why they chose the seafront, is because there would be less aggro from the local population and it would give folks a chance to come together.
Right.
Whereas by going through the town center, it is a political statement.
Yeah.
It is saying, we're here, we're retaking this space to be safe in, mm-hmm. you know? In Lithuania, I think just this past week, I actually have it right here, there were so many, so much violence and counter-protests and so on that it caused quite the kerfuffle. No, I don't have it handy, but I think it's Lithuania. And the same in South Korea. The Pride Festival in South Korea also was interrupted multiple times by protesters.
Okay.
So this is a small town.
I think what we're looking at, though, is squeaky wheel issues. Because, like, first thing that popped in my mind when you said Lithuania, and this is a weird fun fact that I remember, depending on the year, depending on how the survey is written, depending on who's asking, depending on who's answering, Lithuania has consistently, for the past, like, 50 years, been in the top 5 most atheist countries in the world. And Korea is, at least on the social level, very secular. They do have a lot of, like, Pentecostals and a lot of... They have Mormons there. It's a very interesting country. Plus, you know, the traditional Korean animism, and they have a little bit of Buddhism. But by and large, it is a sort of a secular country. And it's weird that what we're seeing is there's a lot of these secular countries with violence. So I know a lot of people from Sweden, and they say that homophobia is incredibly rare in Sweden. But when it does happen, it's exceptional. And I think that's kind of what we're looking at now as well in a lot of these communities where, by and large, people don't care. Live and let live. He's weird, but he's our weirdo. That kind of sort of rural values attitude. But when you do get that one person who's willing to do something, they're willing to do everything. And it's grim. So, I mean, not to say that that excuses anything, but I think it's rare but extreme cases. And I would rather not see extreme cases happening. Whereas when you go to large cities, things happen more often, but at least relative to the countryside, you're looking at things that are mildly tame. Like yelling at somebody from a moving vehicle is not classy behavior, but relative to getting, you know, beaten or stabbed with a broken bottle, it's...
In the case of Lithuania, arson attacks.
Oh, okay.
Somebody had put a pride flag up in their window at an apartment, and someone tried to set their apartment on fire.
The entire apartment.
Like, multiple times this has happened.
Oof.
So there were hundreds of Lithuanians came out and held their pride parade as really making that statement that we're demanding this space be clean.
Yeah.
This space be safe.
Safe, yeah.
And that really, that I was kind of torn when I heard about Kanaki's Pride Parade.
Yeah.
Because by having it off to the side, down on the waterfront, where the only people you're going to see are the tourists.
Yeah.
It's out of sight, out of mind for the locals. The kind of people who would shout from the car. The kind of people who might try and set the house on fire.
Advantage, though, I can only imagine the waterfront is a wide open space, so it'll be easier for security because you can monitor your surroundings much better than narrow streets.
Well, yeah, I mean, I get that. And of course, whilst I was there as well, Pride Cymru, so the Pride for the whole of Wales, was in Cardiff, and it was massive.
Yeah.
But I think that...
But it's an international city. Cardiff is...
Well, I don't know, because I think these conversations are moving along at different speeds, and it really reminded me of Canada as well, because there are some parts of Canada where, you know, the conversation on LGBT rights is like decades. Like, we've got that, we're fine.
Yeah, yeah.
Now we're talking about nuances around gender, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah.
But there are some areas in Canada where people haven't really had those conversations yet.
Yeah.
And there's misconceptions. Like, whilst I was there, the BBC coverage of the Pride Parade was people in gimp outfits.
Okay.
And it's like, what are you showing us here? Like, what's the conversation that...
Well, the media
clearly
coverage...
no one's talked to them about it.
This is a 20-year-old conversation in Canada as well, the media coverage of Pride Parades. That it's always drag queens and the pony people and public nudists.
Absolutely.
But the main reason is that it's the same reason why they always talk about people getting shot and stabbed in the evening news, and they don't talk about good things like, you know, cures for diseases or advances in technology. It's just less sexy to put on, look, here's some banal but, you know, progressively good news. And I think part of that is just the way that the media is built about having to be sensationalist. So they look for the sensationalist stuff instead of just people hanging out, talking with each other about where they're going to go after the Pride Parade. I mean, that's not very engaging news to watch eight people pulling out their phones to Google if there's a bar nearby, which that's like three quarters of pride is just standing around figuring out what you're going to do next.
No, I mean, very little time
actually doing that thing.
Three quarters of pride is staying around trying to figure out where you should go next. It's not going to be heaving with all the people who are also thinking where to go next.
And then figuring out where Mike went and who saw Mike. Well, I think I saw Mike half an hour ago. What do you mean you saw Mike half an hour ago? He drove us here. And then, like, there's a lot.
It's a whole thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a different thing, but yeah. Anyway, with regards to the Chinechi pride, one of the things...
Nice try.
I don't want to go full out.
It's softer.
Yeah, I want to keep it more Flemish and less Dutch.
Okay.
Yeah. With the ch, not with the ch. Anyway, so yeah, even in Canada, our prides started off also unsafe. So we did it in spaces that were less unsafe. There was a few times where you would have like your radical spaces that were in the least safe place possible with a reason, and I don't think it's on the back of a small town to get into the radical spaces yet. I think it's better for them to stick to the places where they'll feel more physically secure and then work their way up, because it's not fair to look at them and say, so you've been doing it for 5 years. Okay, why aren't you doing it in the same way that people who've been doing it for 40 years are doing it? You know, it's a gradual...
I see that, and I get your, you know, learn to walk before you run argument. But Pride Parades...
Progress in 15 years instead of 40. Yeah, I mean, that's...
Pride Parades never, like, marched along the Toronto waterfront, for example, and in Ottawa, they weren't marching along the edge of a park.
Yeah,
you know, when they started as a protest. And I think that in these communities, especially ones where, you know, there are significant questions being asked, where there are elements within the community who may want to cause these folks harm, that there still is grounds there to protest and say that in this town, in this space, I want to see it safe. I don't know, but I get what you're saying. In 2018, should we really be expecting people who just want to build community to also be doing that?
To jump in straight away, yeah.
Let us know... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, Hamilton Pride, for the longest time, their parade went from City Hall to Pier 4. Pier 4 just because it was a beautiful open space where they had enough room to put on a festival. Mm-hmm. But the walking path between City Hall and Pier 4 went through Little Portugal. And it looked like they were protesting the Portuguese, but it had nothing to do with that. It was like, there's always weird, how do we put this? And you could do this squirrely thing to send it down the road where all the gay bars were, but that would add a half an hour to the march. And just like, you know, there's going to be every city, unless you're somewhere like Toronto, where you go up Yonge Street and then you loop around and come down Church Street, and those are like the gayest streets in Toronto historically. Now you've got Queen Street West, Queen Street East, you've got like variation, but like it made sense for them to block traffic in their own dang neighborhood. Whereas if you don't have that kind of neighborhood established, anything you do, it's not going to be obvious.
In small towns and communities, there frankly aren't aren't big enough for gayborhoods. It's just not a thing. Well, let us know what y'all think. What you think? Tweet at TalkCanQueer or Facebook us and let us know. Do you think that Pride parades should be community gathering events, or should they still demand that those spaces be safe?
And in which context? You're not going to have a one-fit answer for everyone.
That's true. Yeah. And it's really difficult to put any kind of answer into 140 characters or less. But there's a challenge, folks. Now, we're going to jump to our first song. And it was one that I was listening to earlier in the day on my walk home from work. It's Mika. Mm-hmm. I adore Mika. And this is The Good Guys, which obviously starts off talking about where all the gay role models, which I still quite like this song by Mika. Anyways, we'll be back just after this with some Canadian news. Crossing back across the pond.
It's not the cowboys that I'm missing anymore. That problem was already old in 94. Don't be offended, this might seem a little wrong.
Where have all the gay guys gone?
To the romance when I was 14 years old, to my heroes that were dressed up in gold, only hoping one day I could be so bold. Where have all the gay guys gone?
Welcome back to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Still Luke Smith.
I am Sebastian.
And we are going to kick off with a bit of Canadian news. Now, we've mentioned conversion therapy a few times. There's a number of TV shows and movies coming out about it right now. Troy Sivan, who we'll be playing in just a few moments, after our next bit of chatting.
When we do, yeah.
Is actually making his acting debut in the movie Boy Erased, which is actually about a gay conversion camp. Okay. It's sort of making the film festival rounds right now. I think Outfest in Toronto have it as well. But the story I want to talk about is the fact that Nova Scotia is introducing a bill that would ban conversion therapy in the province.
Okay.
For folks under the age of 16 and under the age of 18 for those who don't have the capacity to consent. So adults, still legal, but what's really important here is that this sort of pseudoscience, you know, what's being called torture by international health organizations, will effectively be banned in
especially Nova Scotia. Especially for youth.
Well, yeah. At this point, just for youth, because for folks 16 and under. But yeah, this is a big deal. I mean, it's hard to say how much, if any, conversion therapy goes on. I think Newfoundland was talking about whether or not to ban it as well, and they don't really know if any of it happens in Newfoundland.
There's also things that superficially may look like conversion therapy, but are actually just well-intended and poorly advertised. So things like, you know, if you don't want to be gay, come and talk to us. That doesn't actually mean we're going to make you stop being gay. It's we're going to help you, you know, work through your issues. So, I mean, that is an old format of sort of public outreach. PFLAG used to do support groups like that for people who didn't want to be gay. And in the end, it was more about learning how to accept that. You know, you can, if you're going to go the route of being celibate and pretending like it's not true, that's your own business. But let's talk about whether or not that's going to have negative fallout on the rest of your life. Have you actually thought it through? Blah, 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 blah. So there's a lot of things that, I mean, really all it takes is half an hour of somebody who knows what they're doing, asking questions and doing very superficial investigation into somebody who seems to be advertising conversion therapy, mm-hmm. to realize that, nope, they're just a support group, you know, and they're advertising using the language of the people who would be seeking them out, which is ideally what you would be doing, but then you would come across sounding like...
I mean, a lot of the trouble is, you know, there's talk about the fact that, you know, being homosexual is just having a God-shaped void, I think is the phrase used. That they're sullying with these tendencies and so on, and how it would be unchristian. I don't think in Canada that the conversation is quite that obvious as it is in some of the states.
True.
But what's really interesting is that there are Canadians, good, God-fearing Christian Canadians, who struggle to reconcile an interpretation of the Bible.
Or other scripture
that they perceive prohibits homosexuality, mm-hmm. and the fact that they may well be homosexual. Like, how do you reconcile being gay and Christian? There are many churches that do a fair job at that. I think the Unitarian Church, for example, really led the way in advocating for LGBT rights, etc.
Anything with Orthodox in front of the name? They're going to be having troubles regardless of the denomination or religion. Orthodox, whatever. They have a history.
I mean, we can't know for sure, and without going into the details on all of the Canadian Orthodox addendum churches. But what we do know is that there are Canadians out there who grew up with faith or may have found faith later in their lives and do want to have a conversation about balancing those two elements.
Yeah.
And it's... The danger of conversion therapy is that they're led to believe it'll work. They're led to believe that it'll result in psychological changes, that, you know, abstinence is fine and you'll become a heterosexual. Or, you know, the details vary from one therapy to the next. But really, it's very damaging and it's very misleading and, frankly, does not work.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting about the fact that Nova Scotia has done this is that we mentioned a few months ago that Nova Scotia and Halifax is the sort of center of a latest protest where the Seventh-day Adventist Church was having that conference and had invited speakers from the Coming Out Ministries in, I think it was Ohio. And they were they've been called a Pray the Gay Away ministry.
That's one of those states that you forget exists.
So they are gay, the speakers, who are now redeemed souls.
Okay.
And they were going to tell their personal stories of how they're freed from the chains of homosexuality. I'm referring to an article here from the Truro Daily, which has really picked it up. And we talked about it at length when this story broke.
Yeah.
And the fact that it is... They're not converting people at this conference, but they're giving the families who are attending, the faith practitioners attending, the toolbox and the language and the resources and the websites and the connections so that that action can then happen in Nova Scotia and across eastern Ontario.
Well, there is that talk about how do you be gay and religious? How do you be gay? Actually, also, how do you be gay and conservative? Like, gay conservatism is this weird thing that a lot of people... I've actually seen people socially reject people for being conservative.
Yeah.
And my answer is always, well, what kind of conservative? Because there's conservatives that I don't mind. I just haven't seen one run for an election in, you know, about 10 years. But, you know, there is such a thing, at least on paper, of an okay conservative. But anyway...
If you are a LGBT conservative and exist, let us know and shatter our liberal bubble.
Yeah.
And we will be happy to have a conversation.
But they do have a different approach to things. So, like, how do you be gay and religious? Well, I mean, it's there's going to be a way that they view the world that ideally would end with it being okay to be both gay and religious. And it doesn't have to follow...
You know, a lot of the argument is that everybody is made in God's image.
Right.
You know, that all children of men are the product of God.
My favorite interpretation is still Buddhism, which is that all sex is desire and all desire is corrupting, so it doesn't matter who you love or who you have sex with, you're doing it wrong.
Corrupt either way.
Either way, so it doesn't... They like, who is it? Somebody asked the Dalai Lama about gay men, and he's like, oh, yeah, they're sinful. And people are like, oh, gasp, clutch the pearls. He's like, oh, but no, but so are straight people. They are, yeah. They're sinful, like, in the exact same way as everyone else. They're just choosing to go down, well, not choosing. They're going down a different path of mm-hmm. getting to that corrupting sin of desire that yeah. you should be trying to relinquish. And it was like, that was weird, but okay.
That's fair. It's going to be interesting. Well, anyway, Nova Scotia introduced an act to ban it. And we'll be keeping our ear to the ground.
Yes, this sounds very good.
They will be joining only a very few number of provinces that have it. Manitoba and yeah. Ontario already have banned it, along especially with the city of Vancouver.
I would like to see it banned altogether, but my baseline is banned for youth.
Well, that's yeah. yeah, that's what's happening or proposed to be yeah. happening
that it has
in
to
Nova
be
Scotia.
A consent-giving adult. It must be, if at all. Ideally, not at all. But if at all, then...
Yeah, it's a challenge because it's like, on the one hand, I can see how people may be hoodwinked yeah. or folks who find themselves in the vulnerable position of really desperately trying to reconcile two elements of their lives.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And but at the same time, you know, gambling's not illegal. You know, yep. you know.
People have the right to make their own bad decisions, but
absolutely.
Where do we draw the line?
That's, well,
really
youth
hard.
Is sort of where
youth
we're
is definitely,
landing.
Yeah. I mean, we do that with gambling and with smoking.
Well, Canada is really taking an interesting leadership role internationally when it comes to LGBT rights.
Right.
Now, a few weeks ago, we talked about the... there was a big conference in, I think it was Calgary, where they hosted a gathering of, you know, nations who are sort of tackling this. Mm-hmm. And we there was that declaration that came out of it. It's very, all very, very good stuff. What's good now, though, is that Fierté Canada Pride, which is the national umbrella of Pride organizations, is hosting the InterPride, which is the Global Pride Association AGM in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, which is coming up soon.
Oh, I feel... is it going to be in the winter?
I think it's going to be in the next like couple of weeks, actually. It's coming up soon.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, still, they are getting snow there. So they're going to have an international conference in Saskatoon where people from equatorial regions will be flying into the flattest, middle of nowhere-est city in Canada with snow on the ground. It'll be fun.
It's going to be a good time.
The real tragedy of these conferences, and this is not a criticism against the conference. I really believe in my heart they're doing the best they can, but the people who need to be there the most would never go.
It's October 4th to 7th.
Okay, yeah. There's
so if anyone's in Saskatoon, we'll reach out to the community radio stations yeah. out in Saskatoon and see if they can cover it.
A good hearty Canadian would still be wearing shorts.
That's true.
Yeah.
I was rocking some shorts a couple of days ago when Ottawa hit its autumn weather. It's always interesting. You see those memes, which we may be discussing next week, but you see those memes where it's like 15 degrees in April and yeah. people like shorts, 15 degrees in September and they've got, you know, a snowsuit on.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, no, I was determined to get as much leverage out of my shorts and t-shirts as I can.
I also like the observation that Canada has two seasons, summer
and construction
and months with an R in it. And then you have winter and construction are the other
yeah.
two.
Yeah, that's Ottawa for sure. Well, it's quite exciting that we are sort of yet again hosting a big international conference. Fierté Canada Pride is really kind of being, it's. I'm really impressed with their work recently.
Yeah.
Their social media presence is fantastic. Be sure to follow them. And also a lot of the prides that we're talking about are now becoming members, like Kelowna Pride
right.
Has joined them as a member. The Tri-City Pride, which is in the GTA area, has also joined them as a member. So it's all going on with Fierté Canada Pride. So if you're hearing us in your community and you want to get a pride started, reach out to them and see what they can do to help. Now, of course, this week's episode is brought to you by... I'm just kidding. We're not sponsored. I just really like them. I think they do good work. Well, as I mentioned earlier, Troye Sivan has released his new album, Bloom.
Okay.
And is like showing up in that film, Boy Erased, and really is kind of doing a lot of the talk show circuits and kind of really... getting out there. I've liked Troye Sivan for a while now, and I'm quite excited to share yet another song off his new album. This is Animal. I like it.
I told you something safe, something I've never said before. And I can't keep my hands off you. Why are you lying awake? Covered all in the night before. I'm high, high, high. No one's got me quite like you. I want you all to myself. Don't leave none for nobody else. I am an animal with you. Could back me back. It's harder than hell where I'm at. I am an animal with you. As the days fly by, we'll be more than getting through. And in time, 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 we'll build a home for two. I want you all to myself.
Welcome back to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith.
I'm Sebastian.
And we wanted to keep on this Canadian news train that we hopped on at the start of the hour.
Toot toot.
Well, I want to talk about a CBC news story that we found from their Northern correspondents about an Indigenous panel as part of the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Commission that was meeting in Iqaluit. And they had a panel talking about LGBT and two-spirited Indigenous folks. And sort of what the panel was saying, and we'll put the links to this news article in there, and you can read a lot of their comments in it by the CBC. But what they seem to have been saying is that the lack of support for LGBTQ and two-spirit individuals in Iqaluit is putting those folks at risk. And one of the ways that they point to that is that the domestic violence service centers, you know, are designed for women who are abused by men and don't really have a policy for women who are fleeing domestic abuse by other women. Mm-hmm. So we've talked before about the fact that in a lot of urban centers, if you're a man fleeing domestic abuse from men, there's almost nowhere for you to go.
Yeah.
Well, in Iqaluit, there's no room, there's nowhere really for women who are fleeing domestic abuse from other women to go. And even within the spaces that do exist, relationships between the women are just, they have no plan for. And that's just one example of the ways in which two-spirited and LGBT folks in Iqaluit seem to be not fully served at the moment. No, a lot of the panelists who spoke talked about a number of other things. But I think it's a really interesting conversation that we're starting to have in many, many communities across Canada. And we don't hear an awful lot from Iqaluit.
That's true. I mean, most of what I know about Iqaluit is historical stuff, really. It's, you know, explorers and Inuit myth and what's the Indigenous TV channel? Because late at night they have an elder series where it's just elders like telling old stories and it's fascinating, but I don't remember what it's called. Anyway, so yeah, no, it's, but yeah, anyway, to answer your question, news, yes, no, we get tragically little.
Well, I think that's part of what the comments were being made there, that there is a significant even visibility within the north of Canada and the northern communities of LGBT and two-spirited folks. Like they're simply not there. They were saying during this panel that if you go and access services, you have to out yourself and explain yourself because nobody knows. There's a knowledge gap there as well. I'm not suggesting that I can immediately think of somebody who would happily take a government grant to pop up there and do educational outreach. I think me and you are thinking of the same person.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think it's appropriate. Yeah. I think that these conversations, such as at this panel, will be a way of that sort of knowledge growing organically.
Part of it is some of the communities up there have populations of like 50 to 20,000 people. No, not 55 to 20,000 people. Like some of them are fairly remote communities and they just don't have the critical mass for this sort of thing to come up often. But it doesn't mean it's never going to come up, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's when you have, because there's also a building shortage crisis. So there's a shortage of physical spaces in which to have any services. They're working at it, obviously. There is construction all over Canada, including Iqaluit, but it's, again, the critical mass isn't quite there for it to be kicked up into high gear. So, I mean, I have heard bits and pieces about this, that some of the services, like they have the interest, they have the funding, they don't have a physical space yet because it's effortful, very effortful to build, you know, on permafrost, if anything else. But yeah, some of it is just like they know they need to open their doors more, but it's just, it doesn't come up as often as it would in, say, the GTA, where you have several million people. Like, there's more people in Toronto than in a couple of European nations. Like, I think Toronto has more people than Lithuania now.
I will believe that.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's, of course, Toronto's going to have services that are open doors and have all sorts of policies, because they have the critical mass where even the rarest of things are going to come up often. But some of this stuff isn't even rare. It's just when you have a small enough population, it's going to be very rare. doesn't mean you can't write policy in place for when it does happen. And I think it's just that it's turning into one of those, oh, dang, we forgot something moments,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I hope that's what it turns out to be,
well,
and not something deliberate.
A lot of this was, you know, really raising the comment that there's a lot of folks who aren't seen, and I'm really speaking to that visibility.
Yeah.
A lot of folks who aren't at the table and aren't in the conversations. Mm. And I think that was sort of one of the comments that one of the panelists made, was that, you know, the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls Commission needs to be aware of the fact that there are some voices that they haven't heard.
Right, yeah.
And that there is a challenge in reaching those voices. And that's true of Iqaluit, that's true of communities all across Canada. I mean, if we look at Two-Spirited folks...
Northern Quebec has the same reputation.
But if we look at like Two-Spirited folks within urban centres like Vancouver or even like Halifax,
right.
you know, these are areas where those voices aren't really heard much, maybe in Vancouver, possibly.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's certainly work to be done across Canada, I think, to do listening to folks who may not otherwise be heard. Mm-hmm. So very glad that these conversations are happening. We're going to try and keep an eye on this story and see how it develops.
I mean, I feel very lucky that here in Ottawa we have the Wabano Center. So just as a part of my work, whenever I need to sort of poll the community for what's going on, there's a local community center for, well, I mean, there's a service within a local community center specifically for Two-Spirited and LGBT-identified Indigenous folks, Indigenous, Métis, and Inuit. And they're always one of the first people to answer me, and they send me huge emails with lots of information. So, I mean, here in Ottawa, they're definitely heard, at least by me, because they love to talk and I love to listen.
You also love to talk.
Love to talk. So, I mean, yeah, no, very good interactions. But I also recognize that this is because Ottawa does have a critical mass. We have the largest Inuit population in the world, just mm-hmm. because we're a larger city, in terms of numbers, not in terms of proportion. So, I mean, that's how those things go. But anyway, yeah, so of course they have the critical mass where this is necessary. So they're locally, a lot of these questions come up. And the answers aren't easy here either.
No.
So, I mean, it's going to be way harder.
There's a lot of learning to be done.
Yeah.
If you have any thoughts on this, or if you are from Iqaluit and want to share your experience with us or observations with us, let us know at TalkCanQueer. Now, I'm going to be jumping to one of my most favorite topics in the whole world ever.
Trisavan?
Well, yes, he is one of my favorite topics in the whole world ever. But no, I am talking about...
Gin.
Eurovision.
Oh.
Eurovision.
My next guess was going to be kittens.
No, it's Eurovision. Now, of course, as we know that last spring, the Eurovision winners was Netta with her song. I think it was like Toy. I thought it was TikTok, but it's Toy.
It's just Toy, yeah.
And she was there representing Israel, because as we all know, Israel is in Europe.
So very Europe.
I think it's in between France and Germany.
Yeah.
I remember that. But no, Israel is there as a participant, and they won, which means that the Eurovision Song Contest is now getting on a boat, leaving Europe, and heading over to Israel. Bearing in mind also that Tel Aviv is so gay.
Yeah.
In terms of the pride parade they have, it's absolutely off the hook. It is really one of the main destination pride festivals in the world. You've got like LA, New York, Tel Aviv, London. Hmm. It always makes the top five for tourist pride going.
Yep.
So they actually having Eurovision in Tel Aviv. Now, the reason given by Eurovision is that because Jerusalem is sort of more strictly run, the Jewish population there take very seriously Shabbat, which is where they can't do any work on their day of prayer.
I think they've got noise curfews as well, and that's not going to jive with Eurovision.
Well, it's the 24-hour rehearsals, the prep work, getting the stage ready,
mm-hmm.
you know, all of that stuff. It's an intense period of time, which is very likely to fall doing this day of prayer.
Right.
And so they said that it would be less disruptive to have it in Tel Aviv. But I think there's certainly other political reasons why that's happening. I want to move my attention now to what it was one of the biggest news stories that came out. But what's really interesting is that now something like 1/5 of the world's population,
mm-hmm.
1 in 5 of the world's population now has the right to be openly homosexual. Oh. I am, of course, referring to the massive landmark decision in India, where the court... unanimously ruled to decriminalize homosexuality. Now, we talked before about, a few years ago, we talked about how they were going to have a discussion on changing it and vote it. They chose not to change it. And it was it was defeated a few years ago. It's come back again. We spoke a few months ago. I think you spoke with Brantley on the show about how they were umming and ahhing about hearing the case.
Yeah.
Well, they heard the case and they unanimously agreed to oust it. Now, it was Section 377 under the Indian Penal Code, which was sort of a hangover from the British Penal Code that was introduced.
Well, some of it is a holdover from, like, centuries ago as well, that because India is so multicultural, a lot of their laws are kind of boiled down to what's the common denominator between, you know, Islam and Christianity and Hinduism and Jainism and Zoroastrianism and name it, Buddhism. Like, what can everybody agree on? And then you can do stuff in your own community on top of that if you choose. And this has been something for a while where they're like, eh, it's common enough. You know, there's enough denominations and enough of these religions and enough of these sects that it's a good enough common denominator that, like, if you want to do something on top of that and you want to be horrible to your nephew, that's your business. But, like, if, you know, at least at the law level, this works out, which is kind of cynical, but whatever, it's utilitarian and gets the job done. So,
well, this has been an epic battle. I think it has been quite something. I think the law itself was 160 years old.
Yeah.
There was cases appealing the law in 1994 and 2001. In 2003, the Delhi court ruled against the law, and I think that's when we first had a conversation about it. However, in 2013, the Supreme Court shot it down again. So it sort of went up. And they said no. And that's when we were talking a while ago about the fact that it got ruled against.
I always had the feeling that India was again for it the whole time. It's just they couldn't agree on what to do instead. And if they didn't have something that everybody could agree on what to do instead, they were just going to carry on, stay the course. Because it has been a while. I mean, I've been reading news about gay rights in India since the early 2000s. And it's been on and off the whole time where, you know, something goes in front of the government and everybody kind of goes, yeah, that's a pretty good idea. And then, okay, well, what are we going to replace it with? I don't know. Okay, well, never mind then. So,
well, I mean, it's serious and there's real people and real lives on the line here. The Guardian actually had some great reporting on it where they interviewed the Hamsafa Trust.
Okay.
And they work with LGBT folks. And what they found was that, you know, in the past 2 years, there were 18 cases of men being blackmailed by police and other officials.
Oh.
So it's because it's illegal.
You know,
it's like, I'll throw you in the cells, let everybody know that you're a homo, unless you give me X number of rupees or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and yeah, no, this is really serious. Of course, now it's been decriminalized. That leverage for that blackmail is no longer there. The social blackmail may still exist. And this is not a panacea to cure all.
No, but this is a very good start.
Absolutely.
This is a very good
start. I wanted to end the show on what is a very good start to some fantastic progress. Now, 1 in 5 people of the world can sleep a little easier knowing that homosexuality has been decriminalized in India. But we have run out of time.
Have we?
We have indeed.
I didn't sneeze or cough once.
You didn't.
No, when the microphones were on anyway.
Playing out with Ria May.
Okay.
Who actually is coming into Ottawa to perform. I think Ria May is sort of all over the place, truth be told, performing.
At the same time.
No, but what's surprising is
she's
like, Côte d'Epaurette is in Gatineau. I think Côte d'Epaurette is touring. And also the peptides are at the National Arts Center. So really, you know, keep your ear to the ground and you will find that there are tons of LGBT acts sort of touring around the country.
You know, Diamond Rings is back together, but under a totally different name.
Oh my gosh. Well, we're going to have to find out where they tour and go see them, because I adore Diamond Rings. Anyway, we're playing out with Ria May, and this song is called I'm on Fire. Ooh. I've been Luke Smith.
And I am Sebastian. Thank you for listening.
Sleepless and cold nights, getting older and scared. I didn't follow through like I should have held down, should have tried harder. Got a roof, got a job, got a bed now. The hardest spots are the ones in my head now. Don't wanna give up, wanna let me down. I'm not there, yeah, but it's all right now. Fire. Ooh, you should see me now. Ooh, you should see me now. Fire. There's nothing you can say now. Nothing you can say now. I'm not there yet. Cross town to smoke with my straight friends, downtown to drink with my gay friends. Never.